If you want to know what good leadership looks like, look to the bad leaders. Look to the people who really you just never want to be like, because they instantly highlight all the things that you would never do as a leader.
You're listening to KBCast, the cybersecurity podcast for all executives. Cutting through the jargon and hype to understand the landscape where risk and technology meet. Now, here's your host, Carissa Breen.
Hey everyone, it's KB. Thank you for being an active listener on the show. And thanks to you, we've been downloaded in 63 countries. If you haven't already, please ensure that you follow and subscribe to the show for the latest updates. Now, time to get to the interview. Joining me today is William Goodison, Director from Unconventional Leader. And today, we are talking about leadership. So, Will, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's wonderful to have you here. I mean, look, leadership is such a broad topic question. I have lots of questions for you, but I perhaps want to start with, what's your definition of leadership? What does this sort of mean to you?
I think leadership, like you said, it is bandied around a lot. For context, I spent 9 years as a British Army officer before 10 years in the corporate space. And I think for me, leadership that I've learned and adapted as a one-liner, I think, is the ability to lead others to achieve their full potential. Very much a throwaway tagline, but I think it really hones to this point of leaders versus managers and actually getting that definition correct these days.
Yeah, so that's interesting because you've got that great background. So I'm assuming that you've brought a lot of that knowledge from your background historically into the work that you do now. What would you sort of say has been your biggest takeaway with your sort of experience?
Well, I was very lucky because I spent a year learning about leadership before I ever had to lead. The way that the British Army works, you are sent away if you are selected to be a commissioned officer and you spend a minimum of 1 year at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst, which is based in the UK. And there is some phenomenal opportunities to learn because it has grown. And the education system there has been built off of hundreds of years of leadership experience. Now, off the back of my 1 year there, I then went on to have additional training as a Royal Engineer before I took command of 30 soldiers as a 24-year-old. And you learn quickly. I think we'll come on to this a bit later, but I think experience is something that we don't put enough emphasis on. People talk to experts and saying, oh, 10,000 hours. That's awesome if you've got 10,000 hours, but what kind of hours were you doing? What were you doing with that time? And I think one of the biggest takeaways for me over the course of a military and corporate career is there are so many people who don't actually appreciate the experiences that they gain. They don't learn off the back of them. And as a result, you get a real mix in terms of what good leadership looks like. And when people think they are good leaders because they have a title, actually what they're doing is they're referring to their own egos, rather than the fundamentals of what good leadership looks like.
Yeah, so I have definitely heard that phrase, a 10,000 hours thing. So I don't know who coined that. Someone obviously did, or multiple people have. So what you're saying, Will, is that, you know, 10,000 hours is like, okay, that's one thing, but it's more about the experiences that you gain from perhaps like being a leader, for example. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Very much so. I think you can... And I've seen, I deployed to Afghanistan in 2008 as a 26-year-old. And there were times when really leadership was tested to the fore. There is no higher way to test leadership than on the battlefield when lives are in your hands. And yeah, that's a bit extreme, but it was true. I have seen 18-year-olds step up and perform phenomenal acts of heroism as leaders. When everything was going wrong around them. I've seen people who have held leadership positions for a number of years really struggling. And I think this is where that opportunity to really embrace the experiences and the lessons that you've gained over the course of your lives, because it's not just the professional, it's also the personal context that makes you an outstanding leader, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's fair. I can totally understand what you're saying. So I'm curious to know, delta between whether you're the 26-year-old on the battlefield or the 18-year-old stepping up to become the leader on the battlefield versus, I don't know, a leader in a corporate, what's the biggest difference that stands out for you specifically?
I think the big challenge that I've seen, and this has been honed from 10 years now of working, I've worked in government, federal, state, and local. I've worked in the big four world. I've worked in tier two consultings. I've worked in construction. And I think the biggest takeaway is that there are so many managers out there, and management in my eyes, and I'm just going to, my definition is leaders lead people, managers manage systems. And I think the challenge that we have is that there are so many people and systems are designed, and the training on the whole that I've experienced in the corporate world in particular is designed to make you a better manager. So business leaders are actually business managers a lot of the time. They know how to manage a system. They know if X plus Y equals dollars for me, then all I've got to do is make sure X and Y are trucking along quite happily. And they don't actually fully appreciate the importance of people. And people are your biggest value, but they're also your biggest liability because they're exceptionally unpredictable. And I find that business leaders or business managers often struggle to fully appreciate the importance their people play and how they lead their people effectively to get their best results.
Yeah, you are right. And I think that this is the challenge, I think, in the cybersecurity space. So typically, or if you want to even go back to historically, people that get into cyber or tech are usually because they don't like dealing with human beings. So they think, okay, well, I'll just work in technology. I won't have to deal with them. Now, historically, that was true. But nowadays, that's changing face. You have to integrate with the business. You have to go and talk to the board, the leaders, to say this is what's happening from a security perspective, from a risk perspective. So it's really changing. So I guess that's what sort of adds the complexity to the whole leadership dynamic. But I do hear what you're saying about managers. Now, I would probably like to go in the lines of even using myself as an example. I don't think I'm a good manager. I think I'm a better leader. I think because I've got vision, I understand human beings, well, somewhat human beings, the best that I can do. But in terms of the management and the details and, like you said, following the systems and all of that, I'm probably less good at that. Do you see that there is, you're either just a leader or a manager? Is there much crossover, or what do you sort of see?
I think there's a huge amount of crossover. And I think what you've talked to is obviously your strengths. And this is one of the things. So part of my business is high performance coaching. So I will work with CEOs and boards. And one of the questions is actually getting them to firstly identify their strengths and weaknesses. And you can see the people who are very much more comfortable being a manager, and they have to put on a almost a mask to do the leadership component, because I think there's a real crossover. You can't just be a leader, and I don't think you can just be a manager. You need to have skills in both domains. And you talk to the cyberspace, I think it's a great example. I've done a fair bit of work with a handful of cyber companies. And yes, you have got people who, on the whole, prefer working in more of an introverted mindset because they are technically very strong. They don't do the people skills, and they actually don't really need to because that's not what their system or their business calls for. So this is where you have a requirement for the leaders within the organization to be able to translate what their people are saying and how their people are working, understand how their systems are working, and then be able to blend the two together to report outwards and upwards and engage effectively with their stakeholders. So I think it's very much more, especially as the digital age increases, we live in a world where actually if you don't want to talk to people now, you can still be highly effective in running a business or producing a set of widgets that will make you money quite comfortably without having to engage with people, far more so than ever before. So we, as the leadership management spectrum, need to understand that we need to be fluent in both of these languages.
That's totally true. I mean, there's so many e-commerce sites out there at the moment that are selling things that you don't really know who's behind them. You don't really have to engage with them. You just buy it on the site and then you go about your day. So that is an interesting observation. One of the things I'm curious about to know as well is I dialed into the conference because I'm in Australia and the conference was in Alaska, but it was called Leaders Worth Following. And so Jim Bates was the guy who was running it with his company. And he was sort of saying, like, you know, leaders are born, then they're nurtured, and then you're trained. So what is your sort of theory on, do you sort of believe that, you know, you're born a leader? And then if you're not born a leader per se, can you then be trained? And if you're not born a leader and then you're trained, are you still as good as potentially a born leader?
I think it's always a topic that comes up. And I think that there are some people who have innate qualities of leadership. They are born with those innate qualities. But I don't necessarily think that means they are going to be the best leader ever. In my and really easy analogy is sports people. There are some people who are naturally more athletic. And as a result, they find it much easier to grasp and embrace the sporting world. And this is where you get our Olympians. The same in the tech industry. They're the 20-year-olds who can start up a billion-dollar company very quickly because they have natural skills in that space. It's the same with leadership. There are some people who are naturally good, but there are others who have the ability to be trained. Personally, my first experience of leadership was a 15-year-old where I captained the school rugby team for one game when our captain was off sick and we lost and we got absolutely hammered. Now, that then put a bit of a bad taste in my mouth and I was just like, oh, I'm never going to be a leader again. Yet, less than 6 years later, 7 years later, I'm in a position where I'm going off to one of the most prestigious leadership schools in the world and I roll out the back of it. Having achieved some great results, and I went on to have a pretty successful career. I got promoted ahead of a lot of my peers, and I left the army at the age of 31 as a major. I was an acting major at the age of 30, which was pretty good going. And my view was that I didn't necessarily walk straight in as a natural leader. I think I learned a lot of it, and I took a huge amount of lessons along the way. And this is where it will come down to the individual. If they want to become a leader, yes, they need to train and they need to embrace it. Like anything, if you want to be good at a language, you can't just rock up and have a crack at it and think you're going to be fine. You really need to put the time and the effort in. Some will find it easier than others. Some of us are natural with people. I think you've called it out with your own skills. You are good in the people space. That's fantastic. That is a skill that not everybody has. As we know, we've all encountered those people. So it's then acknowledging those weaknesses and being prepared to put in the time and effort to actually work on that and get better at how you do these things.
That's excellent. Okay. So I'm super curious to hear your thoughts now on, can you give me an example of what you believe a natural leader sort of does? Like what is it sort of the characteristics or how they are?
Yeah. So it's natural leaders are a real challenge because I think when somebody is good at something, they make it look effortless. There's a handful of occasions. So I've worked with some absolutely outstanding leaders, both in the corporate and the military world, because the military doesn't produce always the best leaders. There are some pretty special individuals out there who you just think they shouldn't be doing it, but that's the way the system is designed. But the natural leaders were the ones who knew when to say what was required, who knew when to get into the trenches and talk to you and actually give that inspiration or the optimism. They led by example. They showed a better way very easily. And it was never forced. It was always something where you just felt comfortable in the environment. And we've all had it where we've walked into a room, we've met someone, and someone has put us at ease straight away, or somebody has put our guard up. And that's where I think the natural leaders, they find it very easy to just roll straight into that element of comfort and that element of trust. Because of trust, in my eyes, is a big part of the leadership game. When you're working with people, you need an element of trust to help them, to guide them, to lead them effectively. And I think natural leaders are very good at that. And if you don't have that, that's where you then start to see. And one of the things that I'll often advise, if you want to know what good leadership looks like, look to the bad leaders. Look to the people who really you just never want to be like, because they instantly highlight all the things that you would never do as a leader. And it's much easier with bad leaders to learn how to be a good leader, because I've worked with plenty of them in the corporate space and I have struggled, particularly in my early days, to try and manage my frustration with them, because I was just like, well, they're being exceptionally rude. They're being abusive. They are trying to dominate. They are trying to overcome with their arrogance and their ego. Their communication style is effectively useless. They are not transparent. So then I'm just flipping it on its head and saying, right, okay, so to be a good leader, I need to listen. I need to be able to have a two-way conversation. I need to be firm but fair. And it's much easier to then learn and take away those skills so that you can work on your own style.
Firm but fair. Yes, I'm definitely a big believer on that front. In terms of people, would you say in your experience, Will, that most people don't want to become leaders? Because I get conflicting sort of theories from people sometimes. It's like, yeah, I want to become a leader, but it's like, I don't know if you have traits to it, but then you also don't, like you said, have that grit to become the leader. Like you said before, the language, you don't just start speaking a language. Like you actually have to learn and train for that language, so to speak. So what do you sort of see? Do you think people that want to be a leader, but in reality, they kind of know that it's going to be a lot harder for them? Or do you think that most people generally just don't want to become a leader?
I think there's two parts to that. I think potentially there's two parts. One of the things is it's career progression, which is often where you can really struggle, because if you want to progress in life, on the whole, you're going to have to get promoted. You're going to have to take a management position of some description. And this is where I think you really, corporate world misses a trick. Something that the British Army does is, as a junior officer, you have to spend 3 years or 5 years effectively taking a people role as a leader. Now, once you get to a certain point in your career, there's an opportunity to go down the staff route or to go down the technical route. So if you are technically capable, you can go into a world where you spend very little time having to lead people on the whole, and you focus on your technical abilities and you enhance them as a result. So you've got some very senior people who actually have the ability to leverage their brains and their technical components without letting the people side of things interfere. And this is then where you come back and then you're looking at the person who wants to promote, and this is where the micromanager comes from. Congratulations, you've just been promoted. They step into a role where they don't know how to lead their team. They've gone from managing a spreadsheet, let's say, we'll keep it simple, manage a spreadsheet, they step up and all of a sudden they're managing five people and there is no spreadsheet because their role is to manage the people. What they then do is they realize they haven't had any training, they don't know how to talk to people and they don't know how to lead people. So they then turn around to the person who's just taken their role, who's now managing their spreadsheet, and then they start to micromanage because they know how to manage the spreadsheet better than the new person because they were doing it and that's why they got promoted. So all of a sudden, they're just focusing on that one area of technical ability. And so you're coming into this space where people think they need to be promoted for the pay or for the opportunities and all of this fun stuff. They don't really appreciate how hard it is to lead people unless they've done the research, unless they've had that experience, unless they've had the training. One of the things that was very evident in my training was over the course of your time at Sandhurst, you get opportunities to step into a command position. So there's 30 of us in a platoon and you rotate being the platoon commander. So you rotate through being the person in charge. After 24 hours, 48 hours, however long that stint is, you then hand the role back to somebody else. And you see it every time. The person who hands over that responsibility then takes a big sigh of relief and then kicks back to just being effectively a soldier in the background or a troop in the background, just pretty much switching off and taking it nice and easy because they're having a bit of a breath and it's very straightforward. I remember the day that I turned up in Germany and stood in front of my troop, which was my first military command, where there I am as a second lieutenant. And at the end of my first day, I suddenly realized I wasn't handing over that rank slide and I was going to be holding it for the rest of my career, all the time that I stayed here. And that was a bit of a shock because all of a sudden, all the training and everything, you're suddenly like, right, I need to ensure that I've actually embraced and taken all of this on board because there's no opportunity to hand it over. I am it. The buck is stopping with me now. And that can be very confronting.
100%. So on that note then, what do you think sort of stresses people out? I mean, obviously that's a hard question to answer, but as a rule of thumb, like, I mean, you spoke before around the micromanagement. I mean, earlier in my career, I had a manager. I think they were a very new manager from what I was told. That's the first time I had ever managed people, but micromanaging me to the point where it actually drove me out of the job. I couldn't handle it. And I've been told in the past I'm not an easy person to manage because I ask too many questions, which is probably why I love interviewing people. I was curious, well, why are we doing it that way? What about this way? And I think when you're challenging someone who probably doesn't have the experience to handle that, they stress out. They can't handle it. They can't handle that the person that's quote unquote their subordinate is challenging them about how they're doing things. Or I would say like, hey, can you sort of talk to me this way? That's how you get the best out of me. And a lot of the time that was ignored. So I've found in my career, I've been driven out of jobs purely because of the manager. Now, they may be great people, but when they're managing me specifically, the micromanagement side of things started to come in and then I just couldn't deal with it. And then I probably used to push back more. And then as I'd push back more, what does that then mean? They become more micromanagement focused. So it was hard. So what do you sort of think stresses people out? I mean, you've dealt with many leaders. New leader comes in. Okay, here's five people. Go for your life. What do you think bothers them the most?
I think there's, and you've touched on some really good points there. I'll go back to some of the fundamentals that I look at when I'm working in the leadership space. One of the first things is working out whether or not the individual understands himself. Three things that I tend to focus on: their accountability, their awareness, and their trust. So how accountable are they as an individual? How comfortable are they to hold themselves accountable to expectations and setting a standard? The standard you walk past is the standard you accept. Then you have the awareness element. How self-aware are they? Do they know what triggers them? Do they know what excites them? Do they know what frustrates them? And trust, how quickly are they able to build trust? Now, I'll tick those things off really quickly because I think that's part of when you're then starting to work out how good people are and actually then leading or managing other people. Because if they don't have those components or a good understanding of those components, they're going to struggle anything that they do, full stop. And when you're looking at the systems that are designed to train managers in the corporate world, I think they're hugely flawed. We do not spend enough time actually on good quality time teaching people how to manage these things. Because you are a prime example of where greatness can occur. If you have a leader who knows how to leverage your strengths and manage you effectively, awesome. Because they can embrace your ideas, they can give you initiative, they can give you an opportunity to grow, they can give you all of those chances whilst at the same time managing that expectation. Standing in the background and saying, right, okay, here's an opportunity for you. And if you push too hard and you fail, what am I going to do? I'm going to support you on that growth journey because there are some people who will embrace leadership and they will fly through the ranks. And I've met the one percenters, those who go on to achieve greatness. And you can turn around and saw it in the military. I met a couple of future chief of general staffs who are the head of the armed forces or the head of the army. And you're just like, yeah, you're a natural. And you can see them go. Whether or not they were born or whether or not they were trained effectively, either way, they've gone on to achieve great things. And those are the people that you want to embrace and let them roll and just go for it. And if you don't, they will leave. And I think you've given a prime example. One of the things that I will chat to management groups when I'm sitting down or executives if I'm running a workshop, I will ask them, do you want to be here? Is this the right job for you? Because if there are things that are challenging you, particularly the people side, I think often people is often the most important people or the most important component. If you don't enjoy the people you work with, then why are you still there? Irrespective of how good you are at the job, it's always going to drag you down. So being prepared to actually be honest with yourself as an individual working in those environments and say, yep, this isn't for me, and stepping away. I've had six jobs in the 9 years of the corporate world I spent in Australia because I really struggled to find my place and I was happy to step back and move away. Challenging at times, but prepared to embrace it. Whereas there's a lot of people who will sit there and they will spend 20, 30 years in the same job. They just become unhappy because they were badly treated. And so they don't look to grow. They don't want to raise issues. They don't want to raise opportunities anymore because they know they'll get smacked down. So they just go inside themselves and you miss a great opportunity to leverage great ideas, great innovation, and an opportunity for growth. Sorry, I've jumped all over the place there.
I love that. I love a good tangent. No, I think that this is relevant stuff. Like, this makes sense. So when you were in that room and you said, okay, well, who here like doesn't really want to be here? Has anyone ever answered no and then left?
So I've had it a couple of times. And as far as I'm concerned, the first time they do it, you're just kind of like, oh. But after a while, you're then just like, yeah, that's great. Often what will happen, and the way that I design my workshops where I can, is I'll say, right, okay, you do a workshop. 2 weeks later, you then do one-on-one coaching with me, and then you do a workshop and then one-on-one coaching. Because I think it's a growth journey. And yeah, it's all well and good leveraging insights from others in a group environment, but actually the one-on-one is where they get the real opportunity to dig deep on themselves and get held to account. And so often what will happen is I will lay that on the table and then people will come up to me either straight afterwards or at our following coaching sessions and just be like, yeah, actually, I'm really starting to question it. And then you can unpack it. You can have a genuine conversation because they've never been asked that. I think there's a change now in terms of the mindset, and we've seen the talk around the great resignation and the, again, what is it, quiet quitting and all these other bits and pieces. There's good and bad to both of those things. But I think now it's more than ever, there's an opportunity to actually have a genuine conversation saying, if you are a square peg in a round hole, why are you continuing to fight this? Why don't you actually find something that fulfills your purpose, but actually appreciates you as an individual, which is often hard and people don't like to make that call.
So I'm curious to know now, and I'm going to word this carefully because this is not me painting everyone with the same brush. It's just an observation. I have probably found in Australia, the leadership, people care a lot about what other people think in comparison to, say, the United States. Now, I want to get into this a little bit more. You and I have spoken about this offline, Will. So do you see a bit of that? And admittedly, you obviously are from the United Kingdom originally. You live in Australia now. But do you find, well, generally speaking, that leaders worry, or some leaders worry too much about what other people think of them? And then do you think that if they do think that, it impacts their ability to be authentically themselves?
100%. Very straight answer, yes. I think that I've obviously had more experience in the corporate world in Australia, but I've worked in Germany, Indonesia, UK, elements of Europe. So I've seen a variety, but I think one of the big things here that we often talk about, and I talk about this with boards and execs and bits and pieces, the tall poppy syndrome. If you are successful, then there's a good chance that people are going to come for you. And they will try and strike you down. And it's sad to hear that that is still very much a case. And there's a myriad of different reasons as to why that may be happening. But I think acknowledging that that is a problem, yes, a lot of leaders in Australia do worry about that. And what does that do? That massively impacts your ability to lead effectively. It's going to impact your decisiveness. How can you be decisive if you're second-guessing yourself every single time? Often it can come down to the leader not necessarily being 100% confident in self. And I've been there. I left a military career where I had an element of respect and an element of success. And I stepped into a corporate career where no one really appreciated what I'd done. And they're just like, yeah, yeah, that was all in another country. And actually, it's completely irrelevant. You're in the big leagues now. So I massively doubted myself. And I was worried about what my partner was thinking when I was in Big Four. I was worried about what my manager or my director was thinking. And you start to second guess. And as a result, you're always in this position of uncertainty. So as a result, how can you be authentic? You can't. Let's be honest, you are really going to struggle. If you can't have integrity with yourself, and if you can't be honest with yourself, how on earth are you going to lead effectively? Huge component of good leadership is that ability to know self. Know when you are struggling and knowing when you need to put your hand up. Knowing when you are confident and you are going to lead and have the enduring quality or the enduring courage to push yourself through. Because if you don't, then you will falter so quickly. I think politics is a prime example of this. They spend the entire time arguing with one another about what the other person doesn't do well, rather than focusing on what they do well and saying, hey, this isn't going to be 100% right. But who cares? This is where we're going. This is what we're going to achieve. If you want to overlay the battlefield analogy, you can quite easily say, if we're in a position where we're in a firefight and we're trying to storm a compound or we're trying to capture a high-value target, if I'm worried about what's happening, all of a sudden something comes over the radio. Oh, yeah, we don't think this is a good idea. Bang. All of a sudden, I'm going to start freaking out. I'm going to doubt myself. I'm going to say, okay, boys, actually, I've changed my mind. Half the guys are trying to get over a wall. Someone's just blown a door and they're about to kick it in. They're halfway through a building and now they've got to fight their way out because all of a sudden the mission has changed. How on earth can you provide effective leadership if you are changing your mind every 15 minutes? And this is where business falters because of the fact you'll get a new CEO in or you'll get a new direction from the board. And change is good, but at the same time, it has to be managed effectively. And if you've got leaders who are doubting themselves or second-guessing themselves, can't be authentic, they're falling over and their team suffer.
This is so true because tall poppy syndrome, 100%. I mean, I've had to explain this term to people, especially people in the US around what it is. I think they're a little bit perplexed by it. I think it's just the culture of Australia, which is really, really sad because we have really great people here. And I'm of the belief that people are not shining as bright as they can be because of what other people say. So so people who are listening, they're like, oh yeah, that's definitely me. How do we get around it? How can people go, you know what, stuff it, I'm just going to be me. I don't care what my manager or my partner thinks. I'm just going to be me and I'm going to be authentically me, which is a hard thing to do. And I get that. But I've just seen so many people that I feel hold back because I'm looking at people and I speak to people all day. I can understand body language and how they express themselves. And I do see a lot of people probably aren't being authentically themselves. So how can people find other ways to do that effectively?
I think, and I'm going to touch very quickly just on burnout. Just to go back to your last question, I think one of the big things you then see is people burning out. And burnout gets thrown around, resilience, well-being, whatever word works for you. I think you're seeing a lot of people who are just hitting their limit because they're not being themselves. So you're putting on different masks depending on the role you're doing and you're second guessing. And it's just a horrible way to live. And I've been there. I had a mental breakdown in 2016 because I was not being myself and I was falling apart. And this is then where to come back to this whole component of, right, how do you actually become yourself and how do you become authentic? You need to understand yourself. You need to have a purpose as a result. You need to say to yourself, okay, I'm not focused on the here and right this minute. I am focused on the future, the best version of myself. I think we've touched loosely on this in conversations that you and I have had, but my goal now is to live to be 120. So is that realistic? Who knows? I've got massively into David Sinclair and Lifespan and Huberman and all this fun stuff. And I'm just like, yeah, I think there are changes I can make in my life now, which mean that I'm going to live or be in a better position to live a long and healthy life. And that 120 years is going to be a good 120 years. Not get to 60 and my body falls apart. I'm going to push myself, which means that I have to train myself physically and mentally and spiritually and emotionally and all of these things so that I'm the best version of myself. By having a purpose like that, you then start picking apart and working back milestones. And then you're saying, right, okay, so as a result, I need to ensure that what I'm doing is going to be worthwhile and fulfilling. What is my biggest driver? My driver is to support people. That is my kind of like, that's my why, to quote a Simon Sinek synergy. That's what drives me. I am here to support people. As a result, that means when I step out the door, if I'm sitting down with a board member or I'm sitting down with a group of executives, I'm there to support them. I am not there to tell them exactly what to do. I am there to guide and provide insights and leverage my experiences and leverage their experiences to get the best version of themselves out. Now, when I walk out of that room, if they throw all that out the window, that doesn't faze me because I'm just like, I put my best foot forward. And if there is one person in that room who got through to, awesome. When I give a keynote, if I've got 2,000 people in front of me, I need one person to take something away from that. I've had a win. Absolute result. I coach kids basketball. I've got a group of under 13s running around and they're lunatics because they're absolutely crazy and they're wired and it's the end of the week. But my job is to provide as much support to them as I can. I do one-on-one mentoring for charities and I work with teenagers who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. And I love it because of the fact that they're actually the people who really want to listen and really embrace. And you've got 14-year-olds who've had some really hard upbringings who are far more open to learning and being the best version of themselves, far more authentic than a 65-year-old board member who's worth millions, has 14 different Land Cruisers and hates their life because of the fact they actually haven't got a purpose in it. So to be authentic, you must know yourself and actually work out why you're here. What makes you happy? It comes to your point of this component of, if I'm working in a job where I'm not appreciated and I'm not enjoying it, why am I staying? Why should I continue to hang around in this environment? One of the things that my coach loved to say to me is kind of like, right, okay, if that person doesn't like you, oh, well, there's 7 billion other people who might. And that's actually a really, really simple analogy. I have met some very amazing, inspiring people. Meeting the Queen and Prince Philip is probably one of my highlights when I was serving, and it was phenomenal. And you've got Prince Philip, who's just there for a bit of a laugh. Yeah, whatever your view is on the monarchy, fine. As far as I'm concerned, he was just a genuinely entertaining character who's just like, yep, here for a good time, not a long time. And he did very well and he cracked along. Queen, absolutely inspiring individual who you meet her and you're just like, she genuinely made me feel special for the 3.5 seconds that I interacted with her. I'm just like, that's a power. That's a skill. She is quite comfortable. Yes, there's lots of barriers and there's all the stuff that's going on in the media, whatever. I park that and I embrace the fact that for 3.5 seconds, I felt very special meeting somebody like that. And that is what we should all strive to be. If you're turning up and being yourself, you're so much more relaxed. You're so much more engaged. You want to learn. You want to enjoy yourself. We're not going to get on with everyone. Stop trying to achieve. Sometimes you are going to say something that people don't like. So what? If we look big picture, Elon Musk, yes, he's done some pretty crazy, bizarre, wild things. If we psychoanalyze him, we could be here for all eternity. But arguably, he turned around with the Tesla mindset, if we go very high picture, and said, right, okay, I'm going to create an electric car and I don't care what anyone else thinks. Bang, we are now in a position, irrespective of whether you're a fan or not a fan or whatever, electric cars are now on the table and all the other companies are trying to play catch up and they are changing how we do things. People like that who are just like, yeah, so what if I'm an egotistical lunatic or actually just a completely misunderstood South African? You are going on and achieving great things. And this is where the more of us that do this, the greater world, society, life, work can be.
I love that. And I love what you're saying because all of that's 100% true. So, Will, one of the things that's been coming in my mind as you were speaking was, do you think that people, and if we go back to the battlefield analogy around like the mission. So, again, let's use the example with the electric cars. So I've set out, I want to, you know, create these electric cars. I don't care what anyone else thinks. That's my mission, yeah? But I'm sort of the, you know, observation that there are people out there that lose focus of that mission, like whether it's, they're worried about what someone who they used to work with 10 years ago thinks about them on social media, or they're worried about what people in the office at the water cooler are saying about them, or they're worried because they didn't get invited to the company party on the weekend or whatever it was. Do you think that people are so worried about external factors other than their mission, which is probably why things start to falter, in your words?
Hugely. And I think this is where and it touches on our previous topic, this component of actually, if you're not comfortable in yourself, if you're worried and you're always thinking about what others are saying, you're never going to be able to focus. It's like anything. And again, a really simple sports analogy. I'm coaching basketball at the moment. The kids who are shooting the free throw, so there's no defense, there's nothing going on, and they've shot it 100 times. Why do they miss? Because there is something that has come in and just taken them off their focus. And this is where you see people and great ideas fall over because they start to doubt and they second guess. And sadly, it's the way that business tends to work. And this is where I think often some great inventions and opportunities fall by the wayside because we're too worried about the naysayers. Politics is a prime example. It could be that one party completely agrees with the other party in terms of what they're trying to achieve, but because of the fact they don't like each other, they've got to keep pushing and they've got to fight and they've got to complain about it. And your job is to then just undermine the validity. So if you're not happy with yourself and if you're not confident, the mission will falter so many times and you do lose focus. I think from looking on the battlefield, literally talking at a workshop yesterday, when I deployed, so I spent 7 months in Afghanistan in an operational role. So that meant I went outside the wire. I got paid as a junior captain the equivalent of about, $19,000 for that 6 months. And I was a captain, so I was getting paid better than the majority of my soldiers, if not all of my soldiers. Now, the people didn't go there for the money. That is one thing you do not do. You do not deploy for war as an armed soldier for the money. You deploy for the people around you. Deploy for the high purpose of doing a better job. You deploy for the opportunity to be part of the community and the family. Whatever reason you have out there, that's your focus. And you hang on to that because if you lose that, all of a sudden you find you are in a very hot, dangerous location. It's hitting 50 degrees outside. You are carrying a minimum of 35 to 40 kilos of kit. If you don't know why you are there, if you don't have something in the back of your mind that is pushing you and keeping you going, you just sit down and you fall over and that's it. And you are then in as good as dead because it's a hostile environment. So you have people like that who can drive themselves because they know that they've got something to hide. And it doesn't have to be like some greater calling, I'm going to develop the next big sliced bread idea or whatever. No, it just needs to be something that's going to get you through. I fully appreciate that I may not be a famous speaker by the time that I die at 120, but if I have changed a few lives during the course of my existence, awesome. That's a motivating factor for me. That means that when I come across somebody who challenges me and says, oh, I think it's a load of crap what you're saying, I'm just like, okay, cool. I'm going to park you and I'm going to keep going. The first time that I ever gave a keynote, I challenged a friend who'd done a lot. And she said, understand this. When you walk onto the stage, 10% of that audience is going to love you, irrespective of what you say. 80% are going to be completely unswayed and they may agree with some of the things and they may not. 10% are going to hate you. And there is nothing you can do about that because for whatever reason, they're just those kind of people. The moment you stop worrying about the 10% of people in your life, the moment you can then actually focus on the other 90 because they're out there and they want to embrace and do what you do. People are designed to, well, when we go into the automatic negative thoughts or the encouraging automatic thoughts, if you unpack this world, it's one of those where we're geared to naturally second guess ourselves. And so why on earth make it more complicated by taking it on board? But you've got to know yourself. You've got to be happy. You've got to accept that there's so many opportunities out there. And who cares if someone doesn't like your idea? Who cares if your idea fails? For me, I was made redundant with 4 days' notice. PwC, during COVID, they told us there were going to be cuts. They didn't say who was going to get cut. And then I got a phone call on a Tuesday and I was gone by the Friday. My exit interview, I did dressed as a kangaroo because I'm just like, oh, well, it's happened. But he's dead. I will find something else. It may be hard, but worst case, you sell the house and then you just start again. And yeah, that's an extreme, but who knows what's going to happen. So my view going into that exit interview was the HR lead and the partner who was making me redundant. They'd been making hundreds of people redundant over the course of that week. 450 people went that week, give or take. So why on earth wouldn't I actually want to put a bit of a smile on their face? So when we dialed into the call, there's me sitting with a kangaroo mask on. And that HR manager, about a month later, she got made redundant, but she actually reached out and said, I was so grateful for that because that was the one positive in my week. Because it was probably the hardest week of my entire career. And I'm just like, awesome. There you go. I fulfilled my mission. I don't care if everyone thinks I'm an idiot. I made somebody else smile. And if we have more people who are prepared to actually embrace that, less of them are going to lose their way because there's something round the corner. There's that next opportunity, irrespective of what's going on in your life.
That's so true. And I know that people struggle with not being liked by everyone. I think you definitely got to get to a stage in your life where you know that you can't please everyone. And if you are pleasing everyone, you're not being true to yourself. So that sort of leads me to my next question. Now, there are leaders out there. There are some politicians that we know in the world that polarize people. So people seem to be drawn, though, to people who polarize them. For example, as Elon Musk, as we mentioned before, people are drawn to Donald Trump, whether you like him or not, doesn't matter. They are still drawn to him. Why is that the case, though?
I think it links to our previous question. It's because they're being authentic to an extent. They are quite happy to say, this is my view, and I'm going to hang on to this view. Yes, there are the people who may try and manipulate and look for the shock and awe. I mean, Andrew Tate, one of those fascinating people. Again, we could talk about him for hours on end.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's these people where they're actually turning around and they're going, right, okay, this is what I think. Now, Trump was fascinating because there's the good, the bad, and the ugly about Trump. But why did he shake up the political world? Because he was a politician who was prepared to say, this is what I think, and I don't care what anyone else says. And all of a sudden, there are a lot of people who are just like, oh, well, that's refreshing in politics. We haven't heard that for a while. So you can then see why those people are just like, well, I'm kind of drawn to it because at least I know, yeah, sometimes I don't know what we're going to get because you never quite know what's coming out of his mouth. But you know there's a reason behind it and they are prepared to actually drive their point forward. Now, some of them aren't the most amazing people and this is where it comes down to our own experiences. There are plenty of people out there who I think to myself, yep, you're a polarizer and I have no desire to ever engage, work with or interact with you because as far as I'm concerned, I think you're a bit of a loon or a nutter or an idiot or actually just a really unpleasant person. But I think in the society now where it's very easy for everyone to have a voice and you jump online and you come up with a few good ideas and all you need is a few people to jump on board and all of a sudden I'm an influencer, and it can be a real challenge in that space because then they're looking for the shock and awe. I mean, you would know this far better than I do, but the world of the media. When I was serving, we had actually a guy from The Sun. So the Sun newspaper in the UK is the largest tabloid, or was, I don't know if it still is, but they came and talked to us and they said, the way that we work with the British Army when it comes to publishing things is we do good news, bad news every other day. So it changes. So irrespective of the outstanding work you're doing, if you're on a bad news publication day, what we do is we publish something bad because we're trying to grab the headlines and we're trying to demonstrate that we're neutral and all these other things. And so you're just like, well, we're always going to struggle then to actually win over the people because every other day something challenging is coming along. But that's what their world was. And that's how they generated stories, and people love the shock and awe. You can see Hello magazines and OK magazines. And what are they trying? They're trying to get that headline grabber because people love drama. We love to be drawn into this stuff rather than actually just knowing who we are as an individual. I dropped off social media dramatically when I started getting more comfortable in myself, when I started doing more personal development and reflections, when I started getting into podcasts, as in listening to them, and audible books and focusing more on my own physical well-being and everything. I cared less about what people were saying online. As a result, when I do get online, I tend to go looking for stuff that is going to interest me and actually develop me as an individual. I can see someone who's just trying to go for a polarize, I'll step away and I'll just be like, nah, not today, thank you. But I get that I'm the minority in this space, and I get there are a lot of people who actually, if we go right back to some of our earlier conversations, they're unhappy with their lives and not enjoying the job that they're doing. It could be that their home life is very stagnant. So what do they want? They want drama. They want polarizing. This is why we have Desperate Housewives. This is why we have Survivor and SAS Australia and all these people who are just looking for the shock and awe. They're looking for that polarization that draws people in.
Yeah, so true. And I guess you make a great point around, and this is something I had to learn with when I started doing what I was doing, is not focusing too much on like what other people who don't really matter what they say. Like someone's always going to say something, or, oh, you said that word wrong, or, you know, they take things out of context. You're always going to get that. And I think you just got to learn to, as you said before, the lady that you were talking to about coming on stage and talking, there's going to be 10% that just don't like you straight off the bat. Like, it doesn't matter what you do, they're just not going to like you. It could be how you look, how you talk, what your name is. So there's all these things that get factored into someone not liking you. So I think that people are crippled by that way too much, because then they're holding themselves back of potentially then doing something that is worthwhile and that's going to actually contribute to our society. But I want to sort of, you know, close off today's interview with, one of the things that has really bothered me about people, and one of the things that I have seen now being an entrepreneur over the last 5 or so years, has been there's a lot of people talking a big game. You know, I love a big game. Someone's going to say, oh, yeah, this is what I'm doing. I absolutely love that and I thrive off that. But some are really good at talking. But then when it comes to the black and white of where's the stuff at, you know, whether it's in writing, whether it's in numbers, whatever it is, but there's limited walking. So talk to me about this.
I think it's a real challenge. And there's a number of cases recently that I've had to deal with where people have been hired in an organization. I've been part of the hiring process, and they come in and they talk about how amazing they are and they're the best thing since sliced bread. And they put all their demands on the table in terms of, you need to give me all of this because I'm going to be this greatness. And then all of a sudden they turn up and 4 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks in, they've achieved nothing because it's hard. And I think people so often fail to appreciate how hard it is to do some of this stuff. You decide that I think words are very cheap these days. Actions speak louder than words, all these fun sayings. It's very much a case of people lack integrity. They haven't been called out on this stuff before. Or what they've done is they have been called out on it and they've just shouted down everybody else. The bully, the arrogant mindset of, if I just keep talking. I mean, Trump, that was one of the things he was renowned for. The fact that you found something out about him that was inflammatory, he'd just say, nope, didn't happen. And he would just keep saying nope until the story went away. And you see this in people who love to promise stuff and actually all of a sudden it becomes really, really hard. They're saying the right thing to get in. Politicians are great at it. Team leaders, managers, we've come up with a new strategy for where our business is going. Awesome. Oh, actually, it's really hard to do that because we haven't really thought it through. We don't really understand or consider the people or the systems or the expectations because they're short-sighted. They're short-minded. They're going for the popularity vote rather than the harsh truth. And it comes down to going back to previous components of if people aren't comfortable with themselves, if they get upset, if they are worried about what others think, then all of a sudden what they want to do is they want to be popular. They want to be liked. So they say stuff which sounds good. And then when the pedal hits the road and all the, it becomes really challenging. And then they're being called out on it. All of a sudden they have to actually own it. And this is, there's an element of they don't really understand themselves in terms of they don't know what they don't know. So it's very easy for them to try and almost believe their own success. I've seen this a handful of times where I've worked with CEOs or execs or whatever, and they're just like, oh, well, I'm a CEO, so I know what I'm doing. I was once told by a client, you're not a CEO, so how on earth can you coach me on how to be a CEO? Well, I'm not. I'm coaching you on how to be an effective leader. I think what you're doing there is you're embracing your own egotistical mindset because you have a title, you're exceptionally successful. I think a lot of people put or overinflate their own opinions of themselves because they have to, because they're insecure and they don't really understand themselves. They're worried about failing. Nobody likes to fail. But and Stan McChrystal, who's a former four-star general from the US, in his TED talk, one of his key statements is the army always taught you how to fail, but not be a failure. And it was an amazing analogy. I mean, prior to deploying on operations, you do pre-deployment training. You learnt how to lead teams in simulated environments. In one of the back briefings that I got was I killed a load of my soldiers in a maneuver that I thought was a good call. Actually, it was a really bad call. And had it been in war, then people would have died. But it was a great opportunity for me to actually be supported through that failing process. So I was never a failure. I just failed and learnt off the back of it. We don't provide a society where this is allowed to occur in business in particular. It's all about the dollars, all of this fun stuff. So as a result, people have to backtrack. They can't be seen to have failed. I have no issue standing up and saying, yep, I got that wrong. I'll try harder next time. If a client decides to bin me based on that, okay, well, maybe they're not the right client for me because actually maybe they don't want an opportunity to leverage those insights. They only want perfectionism. Good luck. You're never going to find it. No one out there is perfect. No plan is perfect. A saying that I'm sure you've heard before, no plan survives contact with the enemy. Or I think Muhammad Ali or Tyson had said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face. It's like all of these things. If you embrace that mindset of saying, yeah, I'm going to put my best foot forward. I know that I'm making a call based on my experience and I'm prepared to see that through. And if it's not working out, then I'll hold my hand up and we will readjust. Because if I don't, what happens? Well, to your point, there is limited walking the walk. So as a result, people don't trust them. And then what happens? They don't feel comfortable putting them in a position of power next time or embracing it. And so it slowly starts to fall apart.
I love that. And I can confirm I have been punched in the face many of times, not physically, of course, but absolutely. And this is something which I love about being an entrepreneur because you just never know what you're going to get each day, something new, something random, something that you never thought you'd have to face, you've got to face. And I don't know, I think I love it. I love the game of being an entrepreneur, but I really don't think it's for everyone. So it's tough, but again, it's super rewarding. So on that note, Will, do you have anything that you'd like to leave our audience with today in terms of final thoughts or any closing comments?
One of the big things, not everyone is meant to be a leader. I think that's something that often gets overlooked. You don't have to be a leader to be successful. The entrepreneur world is a fascinating one. I'm dabbling in it at the moment as I try and run my own business, and I'm 2.5 years and still going. I deliberately don't employ staff because, if I'm honest, at the moment, I don't think I'm in a position to lead them effectively. I'm actually leading myself. I'm on a huge journey of self-discovery, and I'm loving every second of it, and I feel much better attuned to who I am as an individual right this minute. So part of this, if you're not going to be a leader, that's fine. Be prepared to embrace that. Not everyone's going to like you. Embrace that. The more you know yourself, the better you can manage yourself. I think awareness of self is a real challenge these days. People love to see what YouTube or Instagram or Facebook or any of the other ones are telling them they should be like, rather than actually digging deep and finding out. Because if you know yourself, then you're in a better position to understand your purpose. If you are, my biggest takeaway that I have learned over the course of my breakdown and unemployment and rediscovering myself, having a purpose is huge. If you don't have one in your life at the moment, look for it.
Well, I absolutely love that. I think that today has been an exceptional interview, has been very raw, very honest, and very valuable, especially for me and especially for our audience. So thank you so much, Will, for taking the time out today to share some of your thoughts, your insights and your knowledge.
Pleasure. Thank you for your time. Really, really grateful for it.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you found today's episode useful and you took away a few key points. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get our latest episodes.
This podcast is brought to you by Mercsec, the specialists in security, search, and recruitment solutions. Visit mercsec.com to connect today.
If you'd like to find out how KBI can help grow your cyber business, then please head over to kbi.digital.
This podcast was brought to you by KBI.media, the voice of cyber.